This is part two of the Acceptance versus Abundance PAFRC Lecture 130 teleconference. So if anybody has any questions or comments or wants to do any sharing at this point, I'm certainly open to it.
That was certainly a good reminder of how automatic, how easy it is to be automatic and resist the full experience of simple things in everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks.
Most welcome. Anyone else? So I thought it might be, and you're welcome to interrupt me at any point, I thought it might be useful if I gave another illustration. And there's a story that very clearly illustrates where we may not be aware of our own fears. And this story, the reason I'm going to tell it, even though it has a spoiler, and I'm going to tell you the story and you won't be surprised when you read it, is the story is out of print. And this story was the first short story that Isaac Asimov ever published. And I read in his biography about it, and I was so fascinated because he didn't actually talk about the story. He just said it was the best thing he'd ever written. And he said that once he'd been writing for 30-odd years, he went back to it and thought he might be able to clean it up and do a better job as a more experienced, you know, more professional, more creative, smoother writer. He thought he could do a better job. And that when he tried to do it, he felt that he lost more than he gained. So eventually, he left it alone. So this short story is found in used bookstores, in old collections of his. It's very, very hard to find because I turned it into a challenge to find it and spent 6 to 9 months combing through bookstores trying to find this. Found it. So the short story is called Nightfall. And the reason why it might be a good illustrative point here is that it's a little science fiction, so we're on another planet. And on this other planet, the protagonist, or the lead character, is an astronomy professor, teacher, whatever. And he's in the astronomy lab. And there's an event that's going to happen. And this planet has three suns. And because of the way they move, there is never night. There's always a sun someplace. And as you go through the story, Asimov, even as the first story he ever wrote, does a brilliant job of showing you what happens if it's never night. For instance, they have no source of artificial light. They simply put windows in the stairwells and windows in the closets and big windows in the rooms, because if there's always one sun shining, why would you need artificial light? You just need to augment the light that is already shining down. And the story is about the fact that the lead character has computed, that an astronomical, unique event is going to happen where all three suns are going to be below the horizon or eclipsed by moons. And this only happens once every 24,000 years. But their society is only 24,000 years old. And if I fast forward you to the ending of the story, what the story proposes is as the eclipse or night falls, the population finds that they cannot cope with darkness. They have never experienced darkness. And the population goes mad and they destroy their civilization, which, of course, the scientist explains why his civilization is only 24,000 years old. That every time this cycle comes around, people go mad because they are not equipped to cope with night. And the last scene in the story is he's watching the villagers, like the scene in Frankenstein, the villagers that have destroyed their own village are coming out to the astronomy lab because he's obviously the culprit, and he knows that they are going to destroy him and destroy the lab. So this is a place where art can bring us an illustrative, I keep wanting to say illustrative, but that's a different word, an illustrative example of places where we may not know a fear exists until we have dealt with it. And this is in the lecture, that until you have faced a fear and embraced it and explored it and found out what your weaknesses are and found out whether or not you can cope with something, it's only the unknown, and the unknown is more frightening than anything else. So another way to describe the unknown is, and I do joke versions, and the joke version is the story of the Chicken Little and the sky is falling. So I don't even remember how the story goes, but the short version is Chicken Little is screaming, the sky is falling, and frightening everyone. Okay? And the point of the story, which is, it's very common, children get the joke very, very easily. Everybody's looking up, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. Number one, how would you know if the sky is falling? And secondly, what could you do about it if it was? So this is what fear can do. It can invent something that you can't fix. You can't address it. You can't fix it. It's terrifying. What if everybody dies? Oh, that's a science fiction plot. You wake up in the morning and there's only you. But it's a science fiction plot. It doesn't happen. And if it did, you'd have to cope with it. But running around in a state of tension, thinking any minute the sky is going to fall, any minute everybody's going to die and leave me totally alone, is the most blatant submission to fear. It doesn't do you any good. And we are guilty of that, once again, because we have decided that pain and discomfort is so terrible. I don't know why it's so terrible, but we've decided it is so terrible that we want absolutely nothing to do with it, and anything that brings us to a place of discomfort needs to be avoided at all costs. Anyone who has undergone a personal family tragedy learns two things. Some people live through it and some don't. Some people recover and some don't. And there is opportunity. Even in the worst tragedy you could possibly imagine, for humanity to find a new place to flourish. And people who tell these stories, and we read these stories, but we may read them as much for there's some Easter egg at the bottom of the basket. We may read it as much for there's got to be something good in here, as we do to exercise our demons. If that happened to me, there would be something to hang on to. So there's a place in human society where we scare ourselves because it's fun. It's literally entertaining. And that's fine until we do it too often. But we find ourselves living in paranoia. We live with what if. What if the sky fell? Well, some people would live and some people wouldn't. And the rest of us would maneuver around the chunks of sky. I don't know what would happen if the sky fell. But looking at the globe today, it looks like we're all going to have an opportunity to experience together the equivalent of a sky is falling. Because our institutions are in the middle of massive change. And there is nothing any individual can do about it. Fear is moving, and we might as well enjoy the challenge. And you're either in or you're not. But in life, you really can't sit on the bank. In terms of financial meltdowns, in terms of political change, and also in terms of climate control, which means we're all going to have to do something differently. We're facing change on a global level, and what could be the positive of that is we could finally find a place of mutuality together, where because we need to work together, we find the place in us that doesn't want to, and we address it and open it up. Now, another analogy I use, and I use a lot of them because these are abstract concepts and sometimes you just can't wrap your head around it. In the Bible, in the Old Bible, I quote it a lot, and some people have never heard this before, but I guess I read the Bible a lot when I was a kid. In the Bible, it says, beat your swords into plowshares. Old-fashioned word for the pointy thing at the beginning of a plow. Okay, so take the metal that you have used for defensive weapons, melt it down and reform it to create tools to develop your society and your civilization. And what I play with there is, well, who's going to melt down their swords first? My side or their side? And it's a legitimate question. Now, from a real-world perspective, you could take 20, 30 years to figure this out. From a spiritual perspective, it is more important that you get the truth, that you're not willing to take the risk. You want the other guy to risk first, because that's not mutuality. That's not a desire for peace. That is a mask that hides a desire for safety. You make me and my family safe, and I will agree in future to behave differently. That's a barter. We're getting very close on this planet to really having... my words didn't come out right. Let me try that one more time. We're approaching the point on this planet where somebody needs to go first. And there will be nations and groups that lag behind. But from a spiritual standpoint, real leadership is about continuing to move forward and taking action to bring others to a place of understanding, not to enforce, I did it, therefore you must do it. That's not mutuality. But mutuality being, this is important, it needs to happen, I will go forward, and I will turn around and encourage and help and support you in any way I can, because it is important for all of us to go down this road together. We will all win, and I will do my part in going as strongly as I can, considering my circumstances. Now, I'm qualifying that because some of us really can't do a lot, or we feel we can't do a lot. But what the Pathwork Lectures are about is it's not true that you can't do anything. So while I was prepping for these lectures, I go through this somewhat entertaining, somewhat disappointing phase when I go to teach a lecture where I realize I don't practice this lecture. I go through a phase where I'm working on all these examples, and I look around my own life and I see where I don't accept. I see where I am rigid. I see where I have demands, where I want the other person to move, not just because it's the right thing to do, but I don't want to change. I see politically where I want my agendas to go forward, and I really don't want to listen to the other side. I don't. I have made up my mind. I have decided what the safe and wonderful course of action is. I have decided that their way is second best. Well, can you feel there, what's wrong with second best? What's wrong with not the best plan? Why can't we allow other people to contribute to the future in their own way, with their own dreams? And what I'm describing here is a place of mutuality, of saying, yes. Yes, I want you to enjoy abundance. Yes, I have input. And yes, I will tolerate the temporary pain of feeling like I'm in a plan that doesn't work. Because I need you to participate. I don't want you to go away. And in order to get you strongly ensconced and operational in this society, this civilization, this government, this activity, I need to consider where I'm asking for most instead of just some. So when I looked at my life, it seemed to me like every place I looked, I was being selfish and pig-headed. And the truth of that is I took the microscope way down. I decided to find any evidence of my lack of acceptance, any evidence of my pushing abundance away because I wanted abundance this way but not that way, any evidence of my lack of mutuality. And I found a lot of it. Okay? So what I advocate when I teach these lectures is take what works for you. Take a piece. Take the phrase that irritates you and work with it a little bit. See what you can get out of it. See if you can find different examples. But also, as a part of that, see if you can find the place where the guide's right. I have hit my own places in these lectures where the guide says something and I go, who made you king of the universe? And the arguments just spill out of me. And almost universally, I have at some point been able to see the guide's point of view. And I've been able to see where I wasn't in an open, flowing state, which is why I argued with him. I didn't want to go there. I did not want to lose the control that my sword gave me. I wanted everybody else to participate in a plowshare project first before I released my safety. So again, that's how I work with them, is I take them and I make them personal. Now, once you do that, there's another phrase that occurs a lot in the lectures, and that is where the guide says, if only 10% of the people on this planet truly embraced each other, truly worked with mutuality, truly opened their hearts for acceptance, and truly were open to the abundance of life in all its varieties, we would not be dealing with the kinds of problems that we're dealing with. And what the guide was trying to say there was it takes fewer people than you would imagine for a lot of these stuck places in our governments and our societies to smooth out and to flow. So if you think that, who am I to make a change? The guide speaks it from a spiritual place. You are everything. Because without you, my work is diminished. And without you and me, their work is diminished. So if you can see in a very tiny place, if we aren't willing to do absolutely everything in our power, how can we expect others to make changes in their lives? So that by looking at your own life, even if it is very private and appears to be just the tiniest, insignificant pinprick in civilization's fabric, you're not the only one who is on a spiritual path. And your efforts will be met by other efforts. And faith is about believing that that's going to be true, even if we don't have concrete evidence in the moment. Because a demand for concrete evidence is a way of saying, I'll give if I see that it works. And not saying, I'll give because giving is appropriate. I'll give because it's the right thing to do. And I'll give because it's good for my soul. So I will not demand that the world pat me on the back. I will not be looking for awards for my spirituality. The award for my spirituality simply is And the guide begins the lecture on acceptance by saying, sorry, 133, where the guide says, loving, in pathwork terms, means to relate to life as it is. Loving is to relate to life as it is. And again, we don't stop there. We go on from there. By accepting love, by accepting life as it is, and then looking for where can it be adjusted, changed, improved. And sometimes the only thing you may be able to do is comfort your neighbor or your friend. But isn't that doing something? Even if the circumstances change negative. And this is where in human events, words are, some days I don't think I have command of phrases. The kinds of stories that warm our heart are not about winning as much on the external level, but winning on the internal level. The kinds of stories that make us weep, the kinds of stories that make our heart open, that make us hug our neighbor when we observe it, are stories where somebody opened their heart to someone else. That is the purpose of life. And that winning and losing are little scorecards for your effort produced this much. But that you are more than your effort. So this relates back to acceptance versus abundance by saying, if you have everything you need to live a great spiritual life, you are abundant. And no one can take that away from you. And if you exercise acceptance, no one can take that away from you either, except you. So in my exploration of the 350 pages on attitude, I don't remember which lecture, but many, many times the guide says, attitude is the only thing you can actually control on this planet. It's a game to play. Think about it. What else on this planet do you have absolute control over other than your attitude? So I had a little plaque once that I lost in my travels, but basically what it said was, life is about moving around until you can see the positive rather than demanding the positive. But changing your perspective so that you can see the positive in a situation rather than demanding that it be there from where you are currently standing. The plaque said it a lot better, but I lost it, so I wind up being somewhat verbose. That's the primary amount of information I had to put forward. Does anybody have questions or sharing or observations on this lecture? In my mind, I always hear a little game clock going, dunka, 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 da-la-la-la-la. So I'm listening and I'm open to this. Okay. So let me find one point I had in terms of closing up. Let me repeat something because I came up with some cute phrases. That in terms of wisdom that our elders teach us, what I wrote down was, what do our elders teach us? Do they say, hang on, don't give up, work harder? Well, what they generally tell us is, let go, give up, play more, and love. So if somebody doesn't have much else to offer, we're just running very quickly today, and we may be done.
Very good lecture, Jan. Appreciate it.
Yeah. You're very powerful.
Thank you, Jan.
Oh, my pleasure. Delighted to have you with me.
Thanks, Jan.
Thanks again. Everyone take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.